45% of newly arrived immigrants in the United States have at least a bachelor's degree.
50% of immigrants coming into the United States today have a college degree or higher.
But instead of applying their knowledge and experience to work in their fields, many are forced to take low-paying jobs just to survive.
I mean, we have 165,000 internationally trained medical doctors who are sitting on the sidelines.
Today, we're going to learn about Upwardly Global, a nonprofit with a mission to eliminate employment barriers for immigrant and refugee professionals and to integrate them into the U.S. economy. Hello and welcome to Our Inclusive Future podcast. I'm Scott Harrison, founder and CEO of Charity Water, and I've teamed up with Cisco to highlight some of the nonprofits they support, which are dedicated to improving the lives of others using technology and innovation. Today, I'm joined by Gina Kraus-Vilmar, president and CEO of Upwardly Global. Gina has made it her life's work to give refugees and immigrants the opportunity to thrive, both economically and professionally. Gina's inspiration is her own mother, who immigrated from India and worked three jobs to support her four daughters as a single parent. Gina, thanks so much for joining us. I'm looking forward to speaking with you today and introducing our listeners to Upwardly Global.
Thank you. So great to be here, Scott.
It's great to talk with you. I'm so excited for listeners to hear more about your story. Let's start by talking about your mother. I know she was an instrumental and an inspiring figure for you. Can you tell us a little bit about your childhood and about your mom?
Yeah. So my parents immigrated from India, and my dad was an engineer. My mom had a master's degree in English literature from a university in India. And when my parents got divorced, I was 2 years old. My mom ended up raising myself and my three sisters on her own. And we were raised up in Houston, Texas, and we were the quintessential version of poverty. We lived below the poverty line. My mom was a woman of color, an immigrant, a single female head of household, which is a face of poverty in the United States today. And she couldn't find a job, even though she had a master's degree and she had work experience in her home country. And so she ended up taking three survival jobs to put food on the table for us.
What were those jobs?
She worked as a teller in a bank during the day. And in the evenings, she would work in the gift wrapping section of Sears. And then on the weekends, we would walk door to door selling Avon products. And she pieced it all together. And eventually, she would go back and also go to night school to become a teacher later on. But it was a challenging journey. And when I grew up, I thought, wow, mom, you are so strong and hardworking and persevering and resilient. And when I grew up later, I realized that actually there were real systems and barriers that held her back from achieving her potential. And so for me, it's a real passion and a calling to be able to work with immigrant communities and help them sort of achieve their economic potential in this country and reshape this story, this narrative that we have, that when immigrants come here, they have to sacrifice everything in order to have their children to have better opportunities. I think in the United States, we can absolutely reimagine a different version of that story where people can reach their potential on day one.
Well, how did you first get started tackling this problem? Maybe take us back a little bit.
Yes, I actually started working in conflict zones in fragile states internationally. I have spent 15 years of my career working with refugees and helping host countries integrate those refugees into their workforce and their economies and into their communities. And the reason why this is critical is one, oftentimes when we think of refugees, we think of people who are vulnerable, who have nothing. And I will say people often think of folks that are illiterate or don't have an education.
Right.
They're considered a burden. And so how do we switch that narrative to recognize actually they're hardworking, they're resilient, they have education, they have the capacity to learn, and they want to be able to contribute into their new homes. They want to be able not only to survive, but thrive. And so how do we shift that narrative to one where it's a win-win for both the communities that they're settling into and for them and their families themselves? I worked on Syria and Iraq response in the Middle East, and then I worked in Ecuador with the World Bank on Colombian and Venezuela response as well, and got a real opportunity to see the challenges and the magnitude of the challenges, but also to see that, you know, when countries come together and communities and individuals come together to help solve this problem, we can really shape a new way forward.
And you really, it sounds like you were about the business of changing perception, changing minds, right? Can you say a little more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reality is we have a single story for a lot of people, and we treat people and think of their potential based on that single story. And how do we actually get to humanize individuals and allow them to grow and be different, but also recognize that there is so much intersectionality and diversity amongst communities and individuals? So part of the whole shift is to actually see people as valuable, see people as contributors, see people as contributing to shared prosperity. I will say, you know, at Upwardly Global, we're a nonprofit. We work to eliminate employment barriers for refugees and immigrants who come to the United States with skills, but are un or underemployed, often living in poverty or working survival jobs. And it's really hard for people to understand that you can be educated and poor. Mm-hmm. There is a perception of what poverty looks like. And our individuals, our community is very invisibilized. And so it's making the invisible visible.
Now, this is an organization that was founded decades ago. I'm curious what attracted you to the role, you know, how you thought you could best achieve your life's mission through Upwardly Global.
Well, you already know that I have a personal mission here because my mom could have benefited from Upwardly Global services. And I often think what our family's journey would have looked like if there had been an Upwardly Global in her life. But on the other side, Upwardly Global is an organization that's doing workforce inclusion for people on the move. And that is exactly what I had been working towards in my career. When I started, I was one of maybe three voices really pushing hard for understanding that when people cross an international border, they're looking for a way to survive and they're looking for a way to be safe. Those two things are always in combination. They're looking for a way to work, to put food on the table, to feed their families. And so economic inclusion has to start on day one. And Upwardly Global does it. You know, as soon as people arrive on their journey here and they find us, that's the journey that we want to take them on. How can they best include and contribute not only to our workforce, but also to our communities?
Maybe say something about the barriers. Are they similar to what you experienced growing up, you know, in your family? Have they changed over time?
Yeah, it's interesting because I talked to my mom a lot about this. And listening to her story around, you know, her credentials weren't recognized and she had a master's degree and she was only given credit for a bachelor's degree equivalency. How when she started a job and she went back to school to St. Thomas in Houston and got a master's in education, how because she had an accent, and ironically, she had a British accent because she grew up in the British school system in India, that they didn't think she could teach English because she had an accent. And so I think in a lot of ways, some of the barriers are similar. I also think about, you know, how challenging it is to be a person in poverty and have the time and the space to invest in skilling. And then the flip side also is, you know, opportunity in this country is through our networks. And if you are new, you don't know anybody, right, or you are poor, the people in your networks are going to be people who are in a similar economic situation. And so if you're actually trying to access opportunity and you don't have those networks, they're an incredible barrier. So funnily enough, I think a lot of the barriers are really similar. I would say, though, that I think today there's more and more opportunity. Companies are more receptive to thinking and reimagining what diversity, equity, inclusion looks like and how immigrants can play a role.
And so Upwardly Global is looking to take someone from the first instant and talk to me about how it works. What kind of services are provided?
So when somebody comes through our doors, the first thing is they apply for our program. We determine if they're eligible, only because we're really looking to help professionals get back into professional careers. And to work professionally in the United States, you do need a certain level of English language proficiency. So we either help them work with their English language or they already have the English language when they come to us. They get access to courses and we teach them how to market themselves. We also teach them the American way of storytelling, which is so critical in how we interview and how we relate and understand each other's contributions. And so that kind of becomes a key component of it. You know, if you go into an interview and you answer a question directly without a story, it doesn't translate. The reality is there is a cross-cultural competency around learning how to show up in a U.S. cultural professional environment. And so we work with our job seekers to do that. But we also work with them to understand, you know, one of the biggest barriers is if you're new to a country, like, how do you know if your skills fit up to the labor market, what jobs and occupations you'll be competitive for? Do you need a recredential or relicense? And if so, what are the best credentials or license to go after? What's the process? Do you need to top up your skills? So part of it is also just understanding and unpacking the how do you compare apples to apples, and then where people can start within that journey. And then we actually work with a lot of employers. And we work with employers not only to educate them about our population. You'll be surprised at how many people, when they hear the word immigrant, they think undocumented. And they don't realize that, you know, they're newcomers to our country and they're legally here and work authorized. There's also a lot of questions from employers about work authorization, because most employers, if they're getting international talent for professional roles, they're usually recruiting for that internationally in a select set of like 5 or 6 schools, right? And so understanding the work authorization is a challenge, but also understanding what's the value of somebody who has a degree from the University of Baghdad. How do I understand this person's work experience if it was from Vietnam, and valuing education and work experience from abroad? So we work a lot with our employers and our recruiters, and then we make the connections when we can make the connections.
And I know that the organization has had a huge impact, placing, you know, over 7,500 people. You've got offices in major cities like New York and Chicago and San Francisco. Are you seeing more need, more people interested than you can help? What's kind of the state of this matching right now?
So there are 2.2 million college-educated immigrants in the United States who are un- or underemployed. So we've helped actually about 8,600 get placed at this point, and there's a huge market share for us to be supporting. The second thing is 50% of immigrants coming into the United States today have a college degree or higher. A lot of people assume that the majority of immigrants coming into the United States are less educated. And the reality is it's pretty equally split. So we're seeing more and more of these individuals coming to the country, aspiring, looking for opportunity and ways to contribute, or just seeking refuge. So I would say we're actually seeing more demand in this moment. We've just helped resettle 100,000 Afghan refugees into the United States. The United States was in Afghanistan for 20 years. We worked alongside hundreds of thousands of Afghans who helped the U.S. military and the U.S. government. We had to evacuate over 100,000 of them to come to the United States. And so we've actually got a really big refugee flow right now in the country that's also looking for support. And these are individuals who were translators, who were IT professionals, keeping the military bases going. They were technicians, government administrators. And so these are people who have skills who really want to be able to have an opportunity to get jobs at their skill level.
Maybe that's a good segue. Can you help talk about the role of technology in doing this important work? What role is technology playing right now for you?
You know, it's interesting. I think of technology in several ways. I think one, we have more people on the move today than we've ever had in human history. And that's for a couple of reasons. One is climate change. People legitimately can no longer live where they used to live, survive where they used to survive. The second is forced migration. We have more conflict, and conflicts are lasting longer than ever before. And then the third is technology actually has infiltrated many rural communities across the world, and people are beginning to aspire. They're beginning to aspire for a better future for themselves, for their families, for their children, and they're moving because of it. So technology in some ways is playing an active role in terms of migration and immigration flows. On the flip side, technology is also something people need access to.
Right.
So we typically don't work on digital access, but because of this Afghan refugee response, Afghan refugees are being housed on 8 U.S. military bases where they're being processed both medically and for legal processing. And it's taking several months for that to go through. We set up computer labs on each of these bases so that we could start providing career services. And for some of these individuals who are in McCoy, Wisconsin, which is like far out of the way, or Atterbury, Indiana, this is the first time they've been able to access the internet and therefore the outside world.
Wow.
And therefore actually know what's happened to their friends and their families in Afghanistan. So In this case, digital access has actually become really important for this refugee flow. So we've been doing some of that, which has been both emotionally transformational, but also giving people access to online services, to coaches, to being able to apply for jobs. We have this wonderful volunteer in Joint Base Fort Dix in New Jersey, and he is an IT specialist from Afghanistan. And he applied for a job with Amazon in their IT department. We have a partnership with Amazon. And he needed to take a 5-hour interview. And It's not easy doing a 5-hour interview.
I don't know that I've ever done a 5-hour interview.
We're lucky in the careers we chose,
Scott. Gosh.
It was like the final round, and we needed to find a quiet space for him, a computer, headphones, a Bluetooth hookup. And so it's funny how, you know, technology plays a crucial role in terms of people's ability to access.
The things we take for granted, though, right?
Things we take for granted.
I'm in a quiet spare room right now with a podcast mic and headphones on, and right, it's but that's not obviously most people are not fluent in that would be coming from another country.
No. One of the things, especially when we're looking at helping people into professional jobs, is the difference between digital literacy and digital fluency. And more professional occupations across sectors, whether it's in healthcare or in engineering or in business administration or logistics, are requiring a greater fluency in different softwares. And so technology has been playing a big role for us as well in terms of getting people up to speed for the professional work environment in the United States. And then I would say the last piece is really what Cisco has been helping us with, which is how do we reach more people using technology? How do we match people to opportunity using AI technology? How do we help people map what their skills and credentials equal in the United States so that they can hit the ground running even faster? So I think technology in this sense is also plays an incredible accelerator effect for a population that we know have specific barriers.
As you think about the future, what are the greatest needs for the organization right now?
You know, it's interesting. You hear all these like wonderful individual stories, and we just talked about technology, and I will say, you know, people matter. People are what make things change. People are the ones who open opportunity. For my mom, actually, I mentioned that she applied for teaching positions in high schools in Texas, and they didn't recognize her master's degree. And it was another school administrator who says, actually, I think this is good enough. And it was that individual speaking up to promote and advocate for her amongst a group of 5 or 6 other voices that really gave her her first shot and her opportunity. You know, when we look forward, at the end of the day, it's the same and it's not. It's really activating people and empowering people to know that it's the small everyday choices that we make that can allow someone to be seen and have an opportunity and be mentored and educated about what the industry looks like here and making those connections. So I think community is incredibly important. I think building community is incredibly important, not just amongst immigrants, but between immigrants and U.S. born, between people at the lower socioeconomic level and the, you know, people who are at a higher socioeconomic level. That bridging capital is another huge part of where we know we need to go in order to be successful and to create really a movement that's willing to shift the perception, but also to open doors and opportunities that lead to systemic change. And I would say the last piece is that systemic change part, which is we know that there is a friction between qualified people who cannot translate their skills across a cultural void and a market that is in high demand. We were talking earlier, Scott, about how, you know, this is a tight labor market right now, and we need people at all skill levels, not only to make sure, like, you know, the airlines are running and that, you know, we're able to go to restaurants, but also to ensure that we have the IT infrastructure to be able to do our jobs online, that we have the business administration and supply chain infrastructure so that, you know, things and products are keeping to flow so that the stores are filled with things.
Hospitals and medical professionals, as you were speaking to earlier.
Absolutely. I mean, we have 165,000 internationally trained medical doctors who are sitting on the sidelines during a pandemic. We interviewed all of the doctors we work with, over 300, and 95% of them in the beginning of the pandemic, when we didn't have a vaccine, when things were looking so scary, when we had doctors in New York City who were committing suicide because it was like a war zone for them in the hospitals with all of these corpses in the hallways. And so many of them said, we will serve if you allow us to serve. And I remember speaking to this one Ethiopian Eritrean doctor. And you have to imagine, as a woman in a home, your home country, where you have to fight to get your education already, and then coming here and having more women's rights, but nothing is recognized. She was working as a security guard in LA. And she said, you know, I feel like such a fraud. I am so ashamed of myself because I took an oath and I am not able in this moment to fulfill the obligation of that oath. And what ended up happening is a lot of our doctors ended up volunteering as contact tracers and COVID testing sites because they wanted to serve. So one of the beautiful success stories that we've had under this pandemic is we have a partnership with New York Presbyterian Hospital. They opened up 258 pop-up clinics to get the vaccine out in the summer. And we have been helping them staff those vaccine centers and helping them restaff their whole healthcare infrastructure, in which they both need like accountants and IT professionals, as well as medical professionals. It's really been beautiful to see how, as a country, as employers, we've been able to reimagine how we access and value talent and how we open doors and create pathways for individuals in this moment. And I will tell you, one gentleman who's actually in that New York Presbyterian program and is now has a full-time job in the pediatrics floor is a Haitian immigrant. He's an asylum seeker. He's here with his wife, who's also a physician. She's a pediatrician. They have a lovely, beautiful 3-year-old daughter, and they have been living in a homeless shelter in Queens.
Wow.
And to make ends meet, he was, you know, borrowing people's cars to do rideshare driving, collecting trash to recycle. You can get $20 a day on the streets of New York on a good day, recycling people's trash. Enough for food, not enough for anything else. And he's a doctor. He's a doctor. So he is now went through the New York Presbyterian program and is now a full-time job, which is amazing. And the thing people don't realize is, you know, when you're in debt or homeless, it does take you a while before you can afford to pay for rent. And so New York Presbyterian has beautifully offered them free housing until they get on their feet. So just beautiful stories about what happens when people come together. And hopefully it doesn't always take a pandemic for that to happen.
Well, we've got a bunch of people listening, you know, who maybe represent companies who might be advocates for some of these jobs. How can companies listening partner with Upwardly Global?
Absolutely. First and foremost, a lot of companies after George Floyd have been thinking about how do they invest more in diversity, equity, and inclusion. And what we really are working for is for those companies also to think about diversity, equity, inclusion at the mid and the high skill level. That's where some of our population comes in, but also to think of immigrants as part of that diversity, equity, and inclusion story. So I think there's ways to partner with Upwardly Global or other organizations like us to help build a talent pipeline and think about on-ramps programs or just hiring these individuals. You know, I talked about 85% of jobs in the United States are secured through your social network. So another thing that is really useful is doing volunteering as employers or employees, doing informational interviews, doing mock interviews, being a mentor to somebody in your industry to help them get back on their feet and understand and navigate these waters is another thing that I think employers could really invest heavily in. And then donating as companies, philanthropic dollars is always helpful too.
And there's individuals as well, right? They can contribute to the organization?
Individuals as well. Absolutely. You know, we're a nonprofit, so we use philanthropic dollars in order to achieve the work that we do. Individuals can also be mentors, can also volunteer as industry specialists for somebody who's trying to get back into that field.
And where can people find you?
Upwardlyglobal.org is where you can find us.
Well, I spent a bunch of time on the website before getting to talk to you, and it's such inspiring and important work, such necessary work. And I know that, you know, you've been there a few years. This is kind of the next step in your passion and calling to remove these barriers. And I know you also want to do a lot more. So I really hope listeners go check out upwardlyglobal.org, learn more about the organization, learn how they can get involved through their time, their network, maybe mentorship, and also funding to allow you to grow the organization and to serve a lot more people.
Awesome.
So Gina, it's been a pleasure chatting with you today. Thank you so much for your great work. And I hope we're able to make an impact as a community.
Thank you, Scott. I'm so glad we had a chance to speak about our community.
Thanks for your time.